Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today, we're going to be taking a close look at some of the developments in medical ethics that are genuinely ominous. There are some issues being debated, some words being redefined, and some situations being rationalized. They really do demand our attention. We're going to have an expert with us. We're going to be looking at this very closely, and that coming up in the next segment. First, a review of the news. The big story today, no, it's not Charles and Camilla. We'll get to that. The big news of the day, the truly newsworthy event of the day, is ominous in itself, and that is the announcement by North Korea that it has nuclear weapons and its withdrawal from the six-party talks that have been arranged in order to try to limit, to defuse, and to eliminate the threat of nuclear warfare there in that part of Asia. This is a truly frightening development because all you have to do is recognize what we're dealing with, or should we say who we're dealing with, when it comes to North Korea. You can't make these people up. This is the most inward, dangerous, narcissistic, nutty government on planet Earth, and it is paranoid. That is a bad combination. Now, this announcement that they actually have nuclear weapons means that they've taken about 1,800, depending on the number of these fuel rods, they're now reporting they have transformed them into usable radioactive fuel for atomic bombs. And according to estimates from the Union of Atomic Scientists, they're probably looking at somewhere around half a dozen nuclear weapons that would be made possible by this fuel. Now, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld spoke to this in terms of the announcement made this morning, and I think in his words you see the seriousness of the American response.
Given their dictatorial regime and the repression of their own people, one has to worry about weapons of that power in the hands of leadership of that nature. I don't think that anyone would characterize the leadership in that country as being restrained.
Well, as a matter of fact, it's pretty hard to characterize the leadership of that country as being sane. I mean, after all, this is a country that begins its day with a chant about the fact that the sun rose when the great supreme leader was born. I mean, there is an infatuation with his leadership. There's a paranoia in terms of power. There is a suspicion about all other governments. And I want to tell you, it's not just the United States and other nations here in the West that should be concerned. I think most concerned should be the people of two nations, South Korea and China. And if you're going to add a third, Japan. Because they are right in the field where North Korea could do massive damage, not only by the use of nuclear weapons, but by even the threat of such use. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke to the same issue today, and again, she made clear what America's response is going to be.
This is an unfortunate move, most especially probably for the people of North Korea, because it only deepens the North Korean isolation from the rest of the international community. It's very clear that all responsible members of the international community, and most especially North Korea's neighbors, support the six-party framework as a way to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue.
Well, we'll find out just how many parties to the six-party framework are really going to hold firm on this. And as I would suggest, we need to watch China especially, because China is not our ally in this, but they are a much more likely target of North Korean, well, shall we say, accident even, or intimidation, than is the United States of America. Well, you wouldn't know that North Korea is the big story because in our soap opera-oriented age, the announcement that came out of London got even more attention, and that is the announcement that Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles are to marry. According to the report that came from Windsor Castle, the wedding is to take place on Friday, April the 8th. It is a civil ceremony, not a Church of England wedding. It will be followed by a service of prayer and dedication in St. George's Chapel there at Windsor Castle, at which the Archbishop of Canterbury will preside. Ladies and gentlemen, as the world turns, we now have the wedding of Charles and Camilla. Now, as people in Great Britain are making clear, this is about as big a surprise as is the fact that the sun will set tonight. This is not news, other than the formal announcement. This is an attempt to save face for the royal family. What are we doing here? I love the words of one woman on the street in London who said, "You can't simply marry your mistress and say the problem's over." We're dealing with a prince who's been living in an openly adulterous relationship with a woman who divorced her husband just before this man divorced his wife, that is, the former Princess of Wales. And now, 8 years after Princess Diana's death, they're announcing this, and it is a soap opera, and there's just no other way to put it. And what's going on here is a constitutional negotiation, a family negotiation, because the Queen had to give her permission. And, of course, the Church of England also has a role in this. Britain's Prime Minister, Tony Blair, said that he was delighted about this. And let's just listen to what the British Prime Minister had to say.
I'm delighted for the Prince of Wales and Camilla Parker Bowles. It's very happy news. And when the Cabinet heard it this morning, they sent congratulations and good wishes on behalf of the whole government. We all wish them every happiness for their future together.
La, 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 la. Well, there you have the Prime Minister of Great Britain saying this is a great thing. The whole Cabinet just rejoiced when they heard that the Prince of Wales is going to marry Camilla Parker Bowles. I guess on the one hand, for the people of Great Britain, it will simply be easier for them to have this kind of thing over in terms of the speculation, this openly adulterous relationship. She's been living as the Prince of Wales' mistress for all of these years. But in reality, I just want to point out that this points to the sheer superficiality of this man, Prince Charles, much less the woman involved here. Prince Charles is the Prince of Wales. He is the heir apparent to one of the most historic thrones in the history of the world. And true conservatives are those who recognize that habits and traditions help to form a culture. And for habits and traditions to have a healthy impact on a culture, they must be respected. The one thing that is most of all expected and should be expected of a monarch is respect, respectability, decorum, conduct. Britain's kings and queens have not always been the wisest people in the world. They've not always been the most upright. But for the monarchy to survive, there has to be a basic modicum of respect. When it comes to Prince Charles, I'll just admit, I find this man very hard to take seriously. He looks like someone that gets dressed up in uniform in order to go out on parade. He will, if he becomes king, and I guess that may be a big if, given the fact that his mother seems to have longevity as a name. If he ever becomes king, he is also to become supreme governor of the Church of England. And yet, this is a man who has said when he is coronated, if he ever is coronated, he will not assume the title of defender of the faith. No, in a concession to his own New Age sensibilities, he says he wants it to be rewritten as defender of faith. He went on in an interview he did with Jonathan Dimbleby some years ago to say he wants to be the defender of faith in whatever its form, faith in whatever its flavor. This is a man whose main influence in life was, number one, a grandmother now deceased, and number two, a New Age philosopher who taught him how to re-envision nature and all the rest. And, of course, with that evidently came a New Age morality as well. Now, why are Americans so interested in this? It is because we have no royalty of our own, and so now, over 200 years after the American Revolution, we just kind of borrow an interest in British royalty. If you want to sell a book or you want to sell a magazine, just put royals from Britain on the cover and they will sell. But it's a sad commentary on the age. Will it be a constitutional crisis? We'll see. What about the Church of England? Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury says he's delighted about this. It meets all his expectations. He says he sees no problem. And I'm going to quote from the Archbishop here. He said, "The Prince of Wales fully accepts as a committed Anglican the guidelines that are set down for this. And as a prospective Supreme Governor of the Church of England, all is well." Well, I suppose that's the best you can expect from the Anglican Archbishop, who, after all, is presiding over a church that can't decide whether it wants to say yes or no to an issue as fundamental as homosexuality. Let's leave Great Britain for a few minutes and go to Germany. In Berlin, a 25-year-old waitress who turned down a job providing sexual services, that's the euphemism, at a brothel in Berlin, faces the loss of her unemployment benefit because the laws introduced in that nation legalizing prostitution mean that she can't claim unemployment if she could gain a job as a prostitute. Now, we have watched over the course of years now a deterioration in the entire moral fabric. But when the law comes to this point that it actually removes prostitution as a crime, and now in the case of this one makes prostitution an obligation, we have not only normalized prostitution, but we are now, in the least in this case from Germany, forcing this woman to go back into prostitution or lose her unemployment benefits. Merchtild Garweg, a lawyer from Hamburg who specializes in cases like this, said, quote, There is now nothing in the law to stop women from being sent into the sex industry. The new regulations say that working in the sex industry is not immoral anymore, and so jobs cannot be turned down without a risk to benefits. Is prostitution a victimless crime? Of course it's not. But now you're looking at one of the victims being told she has to go back into prostitution regardless of her moral scruples and concerns or lose her unemployment benefits. This is a perverse corruption of the law, and it's something that in its very logic will come here if it's not stopped dead in its tracks. We're going to be back for a fascinating conversation about the corruption of medical ethics. It will affect you and your family. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're going to be talking about some issues at the intersection of ethics and medicine. And this will affect every single family, every single human being one way or another, because we are witnessing the renegotiation of medical ethics in our time. And this is not merely some kind of theoretical issue. Decisions are being made in hospitals every day. Decisions are being made in operating rooms, in emergency rooms, and in homes that will affect whether persons live or die, whether they receive or do not receive treatment. Dr. Eugene F. Diamond is a pediatrician, and beyond that, he is also a professor of pediatrics at the medical school at Loyola University in Chicago. He's written a fascinating article that is published as an editorial in the journal Ethics and Medicine. That is an international journal of bioethics. It's published here in the United States of America. Dr. Diamond is issuing a significant warning. He begins by saying this: medicine is a learned profession that has its own intrinsic ethic. Under this intrinsic ethic, the end of medicine is ordered to a good that is health. Medicine, he says, as a profession, is a public declaration of a willingness to devote oneself to others and to serve a higher good. The physician is a moral being who professes and affirms the moral nature of his activity. Now, there's nothing to quarrel with that. Everyone would have to agree with that. The physician has a moral responsibility. After all, what are the first words of the ancient Hippocratic Oath taken by doctors in almost every single medical school in the world upon graduation? The first line is this: first, do no harm. The physician is to be an agent of life, not an agent of death. You wouldn't know that looking at what is happening to the medical profession today. Listen to Dr. Diamond's words. I quote here: "We have in recent years seen an attempt to convert our profession to a killing activity. Doctors as abortionists kill unborn children. Doctors accept the responsibility to kill patients with or without their consent, as in Holland, or to engage in the subterfuge of physician-assisted suicide, as in the case of Oregon in America. The doctor true to his calling will not violate the taboo against killing. He will not do it for love, and he will not do it for money." End quote. Now, I don't think any sane person would want to refute that argument. That is, that the physician must not kill, and he must not kill for love, and he must not kill for money. So what explains why these people do it? It is because there are those who simply will not live up to that ethic. Now, Dr. Diamond provides some specific illustrations, some examples that should cause us to be very, very concerned. First of all, he talks about medical journals. Now, medical journals are the authoritative way that that medical researchers tell doctors what they found in research. Now, that matters because the decision to use or not to use a drug or to choose this kind of treatment or therapy rather than another is informed by this. And yet Dr. Diamond indicates that there are multiple layers of conflict of interest. There are people who are receiving money from the firms whose drugs they are supposed to be testing. This was made very clear with the abortion drug RU486 when it was discovered that an article that was published in 1990 in the New England Journal of Medicine, which, by the way, is one of the most respected medical journals in the world, it concluded that RU486 was, quote, effective and safe. But those who trusted that article were not told that all six of the researchers who were the authors of that article were employees of Rousseau-Uclef, that is, the manufacturer of RU486. Now, how in the world can you expect to have legitimate medicine free from some kind of false and perhaps even murderous financial opportunity or gain if they're not going to tell you that they work for the very company that produces the product they were supposed to be objectively evaluating? Now, what do we do with the Journal of the American Medical Association? Dr. Diamond relates that a delegation from the Catholic Medical Association recently met with the executive director and the editorial staff of that very illustrious journal to express their concern that over a three-year period, the journal had published 15 pro-abortion articles and not one anti-abortion report or paper or article. Now, the editors denied that they had any kind of editorial bias. Now, listen to this. I want to read to you directly from his article. Subsequently, however, we came into possession of an internal memorandum leaked to us by an American Medical Association employee informing the editorial staff of the journal that, in fact, their policy was as demonstrated, that is, not to publish anti-abortion studies or statistical studies unfavorable to abortion. So if, for instance, there were to be proved a link between abortion and certain forms of cancer, this is a journal that supposedly is dedicated to human health that is telling its own editors that it must not publish that data. And by the way, there is good reason to believe that abortion is linked, correlated to certain kinds of cancer in women, but you wouldn't know that from the medical literature. What about the use of stem cells? Why is the pattern so prevalent in the media that when adult stem cell research leads to success, it's buried on page 11, and when embryonic stem cells lead to failure, it's reported as a potential success on page 1? This is what Dr. Diamond says. He says this is the fruit from a poison tree. Since adult stem cells have outperformed embryonic stem cells, both clinically and in the laboratory, it's difficult to comprehend the dogmatic insistence by the scientific community of the superiority of and need for embryonic stem lines. What about cloning? Senator Sam Brownback initiated the Human Cloning Prohibition Act. It was opposed by some, only to find out that those who opposed it actually may have had patents pending in the U.S. Patent Office for specific forms of human beings. He says it's even more frightening is the prospect of people in corporate America owning, trading, buying, and selling cloned people as if they were property. Senator Brownback also introduced a bill known as the Human Unpatentability Amendment to outlaw patenting human clones. Now, wouldn't that make sense? Why was this not front page news in America's newspapers? We had a United States senator introducing a bill that would prevent the patenting of human beings, cloned human beings, as products, and it was voted down. Dr. Diamond also warns that we are on the verge of a burgeoning business in the buying and selling of organs, of human parts. We know this is happening in some cases. Some peasants in India, some farmers, very impoverished farmers in India who sold kidneys on the international market. There's good reason to believe that prisoners executed in China are actually having their organs removed, sold for the profit of the Chinese government, the Chinese regime. He also talks about the end-of-life decisions being made in terms of organs taken out of persons who are kept alive only to be organ donors and are declared dead so that the organs can be taken out. By what criteria? Is there a danger that one of us could simply be declared dead because someone wants our organs if we're in a position where we cannot speak for ourselves? There are other examples given here as well. Dr. Diamond points to the fact that in this age of bioterrorism, scientists, biomedical scientists, continue to publish their findings in journals. And this means that anyone with access to a research library can get enough data to know how to create some kind of supervirus that could be used in a biomedical weapon, a germ weapon. Now, scientists say all this stuff has to be published and made generally available. But as Dr. Diamond points out, if it's generally available, then we're basically putting the information for our own destruction in the hands of those who are already pledged to destroy us. Well, what do we do about all this? It's time for America, for Christians, for citizens, for all of us to realize that we have a stake in this. That we must become well-informed as citizens and as Christians about what we face in terms of this biomedical revolution, and we had better understand what's being done in the name of medical progress, with medical ethics being renegotiated before our eyes. How long is it before the doctor can no longer be trusted as a healer, but has committed himself to killing in the name of some higher good? It's time for you to join this discussion. What are you going to say about the transformation of medical ethics? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The issue is the corruption of medical ethics, and it's time for you to tell us what you think. I'm Albert Mohler.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, America. We're talking about the corruption of biomedical ethics and medical practice when it comes to issues of life and death. I've been referring to this article by Dr. Diamond that is found in the journal Ethics and Medicine. And by the way, this journal is edited by our friend Ben Mitchell, who's a frequent guest on this program. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this to our attention today and to make it the focus of our discussion is that this is the kind of journal that is so important, and yet it isn't read by mainstream Americans. It's read by professionals in the field of bioethics. And so much of this is happening outside the site, off the screen, across the horizon of where most Americans live. And that's why we need to have a discussion like this, just so that all of us can be aware of what's happening, because this will affect all of us. And frankly, not only those alive today, but generations to come as well. We're going to go to Jim, calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN. Jim, go right ahead.
Hi, Mr. Mohler. How are you doing this evening?
I'm fine, thank you. Appreciate your call.
Okay. Listen, the discussion you're having is very good this evening, and it's very reminiscent of the Nazi era back in the 30s, when Hitler and the Nazi regime started putting posters up in the street of
quadriplegics. Yeah.
Right. And different things like that, and developing the question of quality of life.
Well, you're exactly right, Jim, and hang with me here for just a moment. You know, it even started in Germany before Hitler and before the Nazis, and that's an even more frightening thing to realize. During the years between the two world wars, the elected, very democratic government of Germany, it was a failed experiment, was called the Weimar government because it was headquartered in what was then the capital, Weimar. And it was during that period that Germans began to develop this idea of race superiority and all the rest, and they came up with a medical approach. I so many times on the air here quote the actual German phrase they came up with, Lebensunwertes Lebens, that is life unworthy of life. And that even preceded Hitler. Hitler didn't come up with that. That came up before Hitler was even a name known in Germany. But Hitler and his Nazi party seized on that idea, and they corrupted the entire German medical practice. Before you know it, you had doctors, most infamously doctors like Dr. Josef Mengele, who conducted not only experiments in mass extermination, but also experiments in terms of cruel torture, supposedly for the greater end. Since these people weren't human beings, since they were life unworthy of life, they could be used in medical experiments. And as Jim is suggesting, paraplegics, the blind, those who had any kind of genetic or physical abnormality, the mentally retarded, those with Down syndrome, they were considered life unworthy of life. And I, along with Jim, think that we could face this kind of development. And you know, frankly, I think if we're honest, we see that kind of language already. We see this kind of approach already when it comes to those who before birth are already determined to be unworthy of life, and those who at the very end stages of life, tragically, the case of Terry Schiavo in Florida, basically, they're saying that's not a life that's worthy of life. Jim, you're there in Tampa, Florida, and the reason why I want to come back to you here is because you're calling from Tampa. And, you know, I was just talking to someone in Congress who represents your area down there, and you have one of the greatest concentrations of people who are on Social Security, because there are a lot of people who are retiring and going to Florida. Now, these corruptions of medical ethics are going to have a disproportionate impact on the elderly. But, Jim, my guess is that most people who are down there in Tampa really don't have a clue what's going on. Would I be right?
For the most part, and it's related to what you were discussing earlier, as to how the media covers it, you know.
Or doesn't cover it.
Or doesn't cover it, that's even better. But what surprisingly is that the Terry Schiavo case is very very much in the media. But not all the facts, of course, are in the media.
Right.
Or the reality of the case. But it should be a more venting, I would think, from the public. But I guess it has to be funneled and channeled to the proper places or people.
Yeah, Jim, I appreciate that point. You know, that's part of the reason why I think a discussion like we're having on the air today is very important, because we all live busy lives. There are a lot of issues we're concerned about. If you turn on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC tonight, you're not going to be getting a whole lot about biomedical ethics. You're going to be hearing a whole lot about Charles and Camilla in North Korea. And especially when it comes to North Korea, that's a very important story. But the fact is that issues like a massive change in the entire understanding of medical ethics can happen without ever making the front page until it's too late. Our phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to hear from you. What would you think about the very nature of human life being renegotiated this way? About the sale of organs? About the redefinition of death? About a profit motive in medicine? These are not abstract issues. This is the everyday life of American medicine today, and it's time we had to talk about it. This is the Albert Mueller Program. You know, when it comes to issues like euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, and abortion, it's easy for us to think someone else will take care of these things. Someone else will come up with a way to stem the tide. Someone else will decide to frame the laws and to advocate for these issues in the courts, and we can just trust it's going to be done. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to be done unless every single one of us demands that it be done. And we need to know what we're up against. Dr. Eugene Diamond has made that clear in this article published in the current issue of Ethics in Medicine. Listen to this. He says the evidence strongly suggests that the officialdom of numerous professional organizations, such as the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, has a hidden agenda of apologizing for abortion and upholding the homosexual rights lobby, despite any evidence to the contrary, and despite the conflicting opinion of many in their grassroots leadership. I want to say one thing that was in this report that I found absolutely fascinating, and it's one of these things that you have to read and read again to kind of figure out what he's saying here. He's talking about how that folks with the National Institutes for Health and other governmental authorities are so insistent that condoms are effective in stopping the transmission of the AIDS virus, the HIV virus. And yet he relates that at one international conference, someone simply asked the scientists who were adamant that it was so, how many of them would be willing to have sex with someone who had an AIDS virus so long as a condom was used. And no one raised hand. In other words, it's all right for them. In other words, for all the rest of the citizenry, it's all right for them to say what they really don't believe. And thus all the confidence in condoms, and thus all the denial that there's a link between abortion and cancer, and all the hiding of the reality of what's going on in the abortion industry. We've got to awaken some consciences, open some minds, and we have to start a conversation, and we better start it right here. We're going to go to Lisa calling from Chardon, Ohio, listening on WHK. Lisa, go right ahead.
Hi, yes. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Did I pronounce Chardon, Ohio correctly?
It's Chardon.
Chardon.
Chardon in tropical Geauga County.
All right, now I know. Lisa, thanks so much. Go right ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking that if people were aware of the widespread impact of the decisions being made today, I doubt that we would handle them with such flippancy. I mean, I'm thinking about the information you're giving us on Germany, where this woman was no longer able to say that it's immoral for me to be a prostitute, and because I don't want to be a prostitute, now I have no unemployment benefits. And it's the same thing. Well, you know what? It's not immoral. Your body's your own. Choose to do with it what you want, as long as it follows our agenda. And
yeah.
You were talking about the case in Florida, and it's an isolated incident. What's one little thing? And it's kind of like homosexuality. I see that. So often the same issue is perpetuated over and over again, where it's just a little, what's the word? You're giving in a little. You're conceding a small point. Where I'm thinking like TV shows like Will and Grace, homosexuality issues, very flippant and fun, and the characters are funny. And all of a sudden, well, I've got some homosexual friends, and suddenly it's not quite as abhorrent to me as it should be.
Yeah, I think, Lisa, it makes profound sense. You're a very articulate spokeswoman for this problem, and I appreciate that. And that's what we need. We need more citizens, more thinking, intelligent citizens to stand up and say, I'm going to speak to this, and I'm going to demand that something be done about it. And you are so right to point to how a small step becomes a very large step, especially when you go from one generation to the next. You know, I would, and you talk about dangerous territory to go into, I'm going to say very, very boldly that the redefinition of divorce law in the 1960s and the 1970s is largely responsible for the destruction of a wide swath of the American family, period. Now, you may say that that was an unintended consequence. I know some people would argue that. And, well, it may have been unintended, but that was the effect. You can't tamper with an institution like marriage without doing tremendous damage. And all you have to do is see what that really means all across our culture and society. The redefinition of life. I mean, if we decide that the human embryo is not worthy of our protection, then I don't care what they say. Any kind of limitation or boundary you put in place is merely temporary and provisional. Before you know it, we're going to have a market in embryos. And before you know it, you're going to have the patenting of embryos. And shortly after that, you're going to be able to go down to the deep freeze, to the local store, and buy whatever kind of embryo you want, at least metaphorically speaking, for whatever research you want to conduct. And these little steps lead to big steps. Lisa, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Birmingham, Alabama, where Rick's listening on XM Satellite Radio. Rick, you go right ahead.
Yes, I enjoy listening to your shows, man, and the way that you truthfully address the issues that people need to know about. And, you know, I'd just like to say that if you really dig down, the heart of all these great and wonderful things they come up with that are supposed to be good for people, it all hinges on money. And they sugarcoat things and make lies out of it to sell it to the public, but all it really boils down to is the money in their pocket. And I'm very distrustful of our own government for the simple fact, it's interesting that you talked about Germany a while ago. You know, in World War II, before the end of World War II, Hitler was using, they put in the water fluoride because it helps to make people easy to brainwash. And they were putting that in the German water so that they could brainwash people. Well, after the Americans found out that after World War II, now they put it in the Americans' drinking water.
Well, Rick, I'll tell you the truth. I am not an expert on fluoride, and I certainly am not an expert. I can't even speak to what kind of other effect it may have other than limiting the development of cavities, but I promise you this, I'll take a look at it. But I can almost promise you that you're dead on when you're talking about the fact that money's at the root of this. And so I'm going to have to leave fluoride to the side and get right to the money, because I think that's your profoundly correct point. And the Bible itself says that the love of money is the root of all evil. There generally is a financial gain or financial aim or opportunity or motivation that is behind most sin. Now, you notice the Bible doesn't say that money is the root of all evil. It's kind of hard to do without it entirely. But the love of money. And that's what Eugene Diamond, this pediatrician, makes clear in this article. That's why the conflict of interest in medical journals is simply so awful, so dangerous, because you have people who are the manufacturers and the agents of the manufacturers of drugs and medical technologies that are now supposedly writing objective articles on whether they work or not. And with the sale of something like human organs, you talk about an opportunity for misuse or financial gain, and the patenting of embryos and cloned human beings? It's a specter that's almost too frightening to believe. And yet, we're not talking about things that are potentially just out there in the future. We're talking about developments that have already happened and practices that are already being routinized in some fields of American medicine. It all comes down to how we define the human being. Either we are made in God's image and deserving of full protection and dignity, or not. And if the answer is not, we are in big, big trouble. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Single day, in hundreds of different cases, life and death are literally hanging in the balance. All over this country, there are people who huddle around beds in nursing homes, meet urgently in the corridors outside operating rooms, and have to make decisions about organ transplantation, about life support systems, and all the rest. All across this nation, there is a system, a network of fertility clinics, and in those clinics are now stored hundreds of thousands of frozen human beings in embryonic state. And yes, around this country, there is a system also of organ transplantation and a registry, a waiting list for transplant organs. And there are people who right now would both buy and sell human organs if it were be made possible and legal and normalized. We have conflicts of medical ethics written across the entire screen of this nation's medical life. Dr. Eugene Diamond has done us a great service by writing this editorial article in the journal Ethics and Medicine, and it should serve as a wake-up call when he tells us that the journal, the American Medical Association, has been influenced by an internal memorandum saying they are to do stories that are only pro-abortion and none that would be contrary to a pro-abortion position. We're in big trouble. When you have the agents of the manufacturer of a pharmaceutical, like in this case, RU486, a human pesticide, who are the ones giving the assurance in what are supposed to be juried, peer-reviewed, authoritative medical journals, we're in big trouble. When you see the use of adult stem cells and successful experiments using adult stem cells put on the back page in order to further the agenda of those who want to promote embryonic stem cell research, we're in even bigger trouble. It's time that a giant wake-up call was heard across this country, and I'm hoping that we can start something right here, start a conversation that can't be denied, and frankly, start a fire that will shed light on this that can't be put out. If we do not, the stakes are simply too high for us to imagine. If we begin lowering the barriers even further in this generation, if we begin crossing even new boundaries and redefining the integrity and dignity of human life even further than we have already compromised these vital, vital truths, then we're going to find ourselves facing a situation in which some of the horrors of Nazi Germany would pale against what we will be technologically able to do in generations to come. We started this conversation. I want to point you to my article published today at crosswalk.com and at albertmoeller.com. My commentary is on this issue. You can find it by going to albertmoeller.com. And remember that I publish a daily commentary there Monday through Friday. Material I hope you will see and from which I hope you will profit. My goal is to lead us all to think a little deeper and look a little wider for the issues the Christian should confront in this generation. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about the proper role of men and women in the church. How's that for a topic? I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.